Okay then, Middleton, I'm going out now. Bye! Hello, Mr. Wolf? I have a problem with my new butler, Middleton. It started off well. He makes a marvellous cup of tea and excellent cupcakes, but, well, it seems that Middleton is in fact a book eater. It started with a few pamphlets at St. Michael's Mount, but now it's getting out of control, and the books make him bigger. He can't leave the house now. He's already eaten the Cimmerillion, and he's just locked himself in a room with the Wheel of Time series, and I don't know what to do. What was that? Oh, I beg your pardon. I didn't realise you're his PA. Is Mr. Wolf available? He's not? Oh, well, I suppose his apprentice is better than no one. He'll call me back. Oh, good. Well, please make it quick. I can't believe I actually miss Latimer.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't had half of your books eaten by your butler. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. I hope you don't mind waxwork museums. It was the only place I could find at such short notice when I realised that Middleton had been too busy eating Joe Abercrombie's first law series to arrange a tea lair. It has a certain ambience that I like, a kind of cheesy Victorian macabre that offsets the linen tablecloth and doilies nicely. Do pull up a chair. The floor is a little dusty. I'm afraid we are without a butler, but I'm sure we can muddle through. Oh, is that the calling card? Oh, weren't you a clever little chicken? Philip Reeve, writer and illustrator. Oh, it's a little bit damp. Oh, it's not you, little chicken. I think that must be the Dartmoor rain. Send him in. For those of you who don't know, Philip Reeve is a multiple award-winning author and illustrator. He wrote the Predator Cities series, which is one of my all-time favourites. Do read it if you haven't. The first book is called Mortal Engines. And also Here Lies Arthur, which won the Carnegie Medal. He has written several books with the wonderful illustrator Sarah McIntyre, and has just had a new science fiction novel published, called Railhead.
Hello, Philip. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Hello. Thank you very much. I'm fine, thanks.
Excellent. Would you care for some tea?
Oh, lovely. Thank you.
And how do you take your tea?
White, but with no sugar, please.
Ah, excellent. In other words, the perfect way, but I shouldn't say such things.
No, I think everybody knows that's the perfect way, don't they, really? They might not admit it, but...
Now, would you like a pug cake? Now, I have to say, they are not made with pugs. They're just a cupcake with frosting made to look like a pug. They were the new butler's creation.
Oh, okay. Well, as long as they contain no actual pug, that's fine. They sound lovely.
Yes, I have actually tested them myself, and yes, I can give you my 100% no pug ingredients guarantee, which is a rare thing, I can tell you.
Excellent, yes.
Don't mind the chickens over there. You're not allergic to chickens, are you?
No, I'm fine with chickens. Yep.
Oh, marvellous. Excellent. So in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you today. What have you decided to bring with you?
Well, I've kind of had to bring 33 curios with me because my new book with Sarah McIntyre features 66 pugs. And obviously she needed 66 pugs to model for her. And now that the book's finished, what do we do with them? So we've split them between us evenly. So I've got 33 and they've had to come along with me because I couldn't find a pug sitter. So,
oh my goodness, are they outside?
They are, yes. Do you mind if I just call them in?
No, we can't leave them out in the cold. No, bring them in.
Okay, pugs! Come on, pugs! Yep, yep, come. Yep, there we go. There's Steve and Buckaroo, Teasel, Moby, Leonard Cohen, Rusty, Hudson, Vasquez, Amundsen. I won't go through all of them all, but you know they're good little dogs.
Hudson and Vasquez.
Oh yes.
Oh wow, they are immediately my favourites.
Good. Well, it was quite hard coming up with 66 pug names off the cuff because it was quite a last minute decision to give them all names on the back end papers. So there are some fairly dubious decisions in there. They wouldn't let me call a pug Love Rocket X111. Oh, sorry, it's Love Rocket. It's Love Missile F111, isn't it? That's right.
Oh my goodness.
Because it would be stupid otherwise.
That is really quite extraordinary.
Yeah. I kind of want a pug called Love Missile F111 now. I never really wanted a pug before.
Pugs are really quite extraordinary. I'm glad that the chickens are in the pen because they do seem to be slightly distressed.
I think a chicken could probably take a pug. I think in that. I think the pug's likely to come off worse, so you needn't worry. But that is probably a good thing.
Ah, good. Well, they seem to be settling down. Well, goodness me. Well, I think that is actually one of the most extraordinary curios that's ever been brought into my tea lair. Goodness. Okay, the Predator Cities series is just being re-released now with its gorgeous new covers for the 15th anniversary.
Yes.
And I adore them, and I'm so relieved because I've waited for ages to buy all four in a pristine collection for myself and for my son for when he's old enough. So I'm thrilled. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about this is that it's the 15th anniversary, so this is really, you know, impressive. And when I asked lovely people on Twitter what they would like to ask you, I had loads of questions about Predator Cities. And so what my question is that you finished that series a long time ago. Is it hard being brought back to it all of the time because there are so many fans and so many people who love it and rediscover it? Or do you love having to talk about it again and again and again?
No, I mean, it's always nice when people know it and want to discuss it. The only trouble is I kind of find it harder and harder to remember the details now. Because it's a long time. I mean, it is. I think it's actually, new books have been bought out a little bit early. The 15th anniversary is actually next year. But it must be getting close to the 25th anniversary of the day I sat down and started writing Mortal Engines.
Wow.
Because I was writing it for a long, long time before I even, you know, started trying to find a publisher. And then it took a long time to get a publisher. And then it took a while for them to get around to actually publishing it. So I was living in that world for a long, long while. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I decided that, I should probably do something else. So I kind of pretty much cut my ties with the Mortal Engines world. And I've been going off doing other things, really. And I do find that it's all faded. It's kind of gone. I remember the big picture, but a lot of the little details have gone. And people will say to me, oh, you know, what about, the dog in the first one? And I think, dog? Dog? What's the thing is, people who are reading it now know it a great deal better than I do. Because I try never to look back at books once they're published. Now, occasionally you have to read a page in an event or something. But other than that, I would never dream of sitting down and reading one of my own books once it's out. So that means I haven't read Mortal Engines for 14 years. And people have kind of, you know, been born and grown up and started reading it during that time. And they know it much, much better than I do. So
I find there's a great difference between different authors on this. I've interviewed an author in the past who was very, very adamant that he did not want to talk about anything from a really massive portion of his career. And it's one of the things that he's best known for. And he was like, no, I don't want to talk about that. And I was like, that's totally fine. And it's that tension, isn't it, between us as creatives wanting to always move on to the next thing because that's exciting and what we're working on at the moment, but also appreciating and loving the fact that there are people who are discovering something that we have put so much into.
Yes. If I'm known at all, I'm usually known for Mortal Engines. So I do have to talk about it and I have a kind of responsibility to talk about it. But if you don't, you end up like kind of old rock star who won't play the hits.
Yes.
new album, you know. But, you know, the new thing is what I know about at the moment, and it's what I've been working on, and it's kind of what reflects me now. And Model Engines was really basically written by somebody else. I was in my 20s when I started that, and I'm 50 now. So, you know, it's harder and harder to talk about it.
Yeah. So you live in a very wild rural location in countryside, which is bleak and beautiful and quite brutal. Have you found that that's had an impact on your writing?
I don't know that it has particularly. I mean, I've occasionally used the landscape. I wrote a historical novel called Here Lies Arthur a while back, and that was very much based on being out in the wilds, and there are little snippets of Dartmoor, which is where I live, appear in that book. But no, generally I'm kind of, you know, usually I'm imagining quite different places, and the moor is kind of where I escape to in the middle of the middle of the working day. I go out for a walk, kind of. I quite like that contrast. So certainly with the new book I've been doing, Railhead, it's very, very deliberately, very futuristic and quite urban, most of it, and set in this very sort of high-tech built environment. So yes, the reason I can't really claim to have any direct influence from Dartmoor on that, but I suppose there is a kind of an indirect influence in that it's you know, Dartmoor gives another space to get out and walk and breathe some fresh air and think, and ideas come to you when you're walking. So
yes.
Very often when you stop, you know, you can work and work and work all day at something, and it never comes into focus. And then you stop and do something else. You make the tea or do the washing up or something. And suddenly you think, oh, OK, I know what needs to happen next. So there is much to be said, I think, for just, you know, some other task or activity.
Yes, yes, definitely. The pugs being very relevant here, the series of books that you are doing with the utterly marvellous Sarah McIntyre, you have really vibrant, exciting launch events and kind of series of tours and things with these incredible costumes. I was wondering if you have a costume that you secretly hope you will be able to wear at some future point, or something you'd love to dress up as in the future.
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I'm not a great one for dressing up. I never go to sort of fancy dress parties or anything like that. But Sarah McIntyre is always, she is the best dressed and best behatted person on the children's book scene, or any book scene.
Yes,
or
she's amazing.
In the world, I think. In the world, she is the best dressed. So she's quite famous. So I had to sort of up my game a bit to compete with her. And I think about 6 years ago, and I was thinking, oh no, what am I going to do? So I was thinking maybe I should just sort of give up writing and go back to illustration, which is what I did originally. I had this friendship with Sarah, and we'd always said we ought to do a book together. So we said, okay, let's you know, start something. And I realized that was going to be my new thing, you know. So I kind of very deliberately set out to do something very different from Mortal Engines, you know, to just start again, really. It was my new career. And part of that was to, you know, cast off all the kind of tweedy suits and ties and things that I used to wear, and have a new look. So with every new book, there is now a new look. I kind of wait for McIntyre's suggestion as to what it should actually be. At the moment, for Pugs of the Frozen North, we're kind of rocking this look that, if minor Soviet satellite states had entered the Eurovision Song Contest in the 1970s, this is how they would have dressed. I don't know quite what that's got to do with pugs, but you know, we feel it. We feel more interesting than we do if we just turned up in our everyday clothes and talked about pugs.
Definitely. I've seen pictures of that costume, and that is just such a fitting description. I have to say that your David Bowie homage was my favourite so far. That lipstick was just awesome.
Yes, there was a blue wig that arrived a bit late, actually. So most of the photographs don't have the wigs, but the wig, I think, takes it to another level. I was basically kind of 30 years too late and 20 years too old to, or no, possibly 30 years too old to dress like that. But I felt it was kind of my last chance to dip my toe into the sort of glam rock. So
no one is never too old for a fabulous wig. Never too old. It has to be a rule.
That's true. I felt my little wizened face peering out from amid the glitter and tat was maybe not quite what people would want to see. But there we go.
Oh, you're too hard on yourself. So the next question I have is very serious. If the world was imperiled and you were called upon to save it, which hat would you wear?
Oh, good grief. When you say which hat, you mean a metaphorical hat?
Any hat. If you could have any hat in the world that you wanted to wear in the event of saving the world, which would it be?
The only hat really worth wearing is a fedora.
Oh, marvellous choice, sir.
There is no other. It is the king of hats. And there is no other hat. There is no point in wearing any other sort of hat. Unless, you know, some kind of protective headgear, I suppose, might be worth adopting if you're in a kind of a world-saving situation, if there was kind of rubble or something like that falling. So maybe some sort of, you know, some kind of hard hat worn under the fedora, I think.
Yeah. I'm thinking like the Merlin kind of metal skull cap thing from Excalibur.
Oh, yeah.
Under a fedora.
Well, yes. I'll have me Nicol Williamson skull cap and then a fedora on top. That'll do the trick.
Marvellous. Two hats for the price of one.
Yes. So a properly, you know, a well-blocked fedora ought to be able to deal with any amount of falling debris, I should think.
Yes. And channeling that Indiana Jones kind of spirit and things would be helpful.
Yes. You're assuming I'm going to take some active part in the saving of the world, of course. Seems wildly unlikely, but who knows?
Well, you never know. When people are called upon, they can do extraordinary things.
Suppose.
So I have some questions from lovely people on Twitter, my favourite of which is from a chap called Jesper Haglund, who asked, what is best in life?
Biscuits.
Biscuits! It's not crushing your enemies or the lamentation of their women.
No, really. No, biscuits. Biscuits. I think that's probably the original quote was best in life. Biscuits, crushing your enemies and the lamentation of their women. So I just kind of go for the biscuits, really.
Oh, that's marvellous. I can just see Arnold Schwarzenegger as Conan saying, biscuits.
It has happened. It needs to happen. Yeah.
It does. So my next question is, I'm afraid, diving back to the Predator City series. And this is from James Mitchell. And I agree with him in that he says that the quartet of books feels like it grows organically. And I think all really good fiction should feel organic. He would like to know how much of it was actually planned out. And did you know that it was four books when you started?
Oh, no, I didn't. I mean, I didn't even know that it was one book when I started, because I'd never had any writing published, and I didn't know how you even went about getting published. So I just started writing this thing as a kind of hobby. And then about halfway through, I thought, this is, you know, not bad. So I'm going to see if I can get a publisher. And eventually I did. But it had never occurred to me that it was going to be more than one book. And that's why I kind of kill everybody off at the end.
All spoilers.
So it was really only after it was published and Scholastic, my publisher, said, well, you know, what's the second one going to be about? I thought, oh, lovely. I wish I hadn't killed everybody off at the end now. But there were a few survivors, so I was able to kind of, you know, they regrouped and had another adventure. And then I suppose while I was writing the second one, then I started to look a bit ahead and think, okay, I can kind of see what sort of place we're going to. But no, there was never any plan. I never really had any idea what I was doing. I made it up as I went along. It just sort of reflects whatever I happened to be interested in at the time I was writing. And it spanned a period of my life where there were quite a lot of changes. I had some serious illness and my son was born and things like that. So you know, there were a lot of sort of changes happening to my attitudes and my view of the world. So I'm sure that is reflected in the books as they go along.
I think go on.
I was going to say, I suspect there's all sorts of continuity errors and things that don't quite add up between them, I dare say. But I don't care. I think that's all right. I think that's okay in a made-up world. You know, I think it's all right if you have a better idea or just kind of just change it. As long, you know, to a certain extent, you can't sort of do that with characters. They have to remain more or less consistent. But I think if you kind of, you know, you suddenly need another city somewhere, you just pop it in. It's all right. It's fine. Nobody minds. That's why people like reading fantasy, because it's made up. You don't need to set off with some great map of where everything is and, you know, knowledge of the gross domestic product of the country. It's really not necessary. Just make it up.
It's all right. Make up as you go along. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. It's interesting that you say that, because I discovered them, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, and they are now in my top, well, five books. I mean, they take four of the slots, so no, maybe they have to be one in one entity as a series. But they are like my all-time favourite books ever. And one of the things that's really fascinating hearing you say that is that when you start to read a series in which you know there are four books, I think there is a kind of implicit assumption about the narrative structures and plot arcs. So when I was reading the first book, when various things happened towards the end, I was like, oh my God, I did not see that coming. I thought that this character and this character and this character were going to be staples throughout all four books because...
Yeah, I suppose that's true. And that's an advantage of not knowing what you're doing. It's surprising. Because certainly, yes, if I had had a deal before I started writing Mortal Engines and they'd said, okay, we want this to be a trilogy. Yes, you know, there are characters who, you know, there is a character who would have been like the overarching villain. There are things that happen at the end of Mortal Engines that I would have saved for the big climax at the end of the third one. But because I was kind of doing it piecemeal, making it up as I went along book by book, I kind of used up all my big climax at the end of the first one. And then I had to think of another bigger climax or a climax at least. So it does. I think it's, you know, I think it's good. I think it makes you, it keeps you from falling into those ruts.
Mm, yeah, definitely. So the last question I have from Twitter again is from Alexander Mackey, and he has asked, in terms of method, do you write any differently depending on the age of the target audience?
Oh, that's a good one. I don't think I do particularly. When I'm writing the books with Sarah McIntyre, and we kind of work on them together, we both come up with the story together, so it's a very different experience. It's not like Mortal Engines or Railhead where I'm sitting here desperately trying to make something up on my own. I can just Skype McIntyre and say, what happens next? And she sees monkeys. And I go, what? You're mad. Oh, right. So it's different from that point of view. But the actual business of putting words on a page and trying to create a scene in the reader's mind is very much the same. And I don't really sort of know enough about young readers to be able to target the vocabulary at them or anything like that. You know, I think occasionally I'll talk to children's writers or sort of would-be aspiring children's writers who read all the advice and things, and they'll say, oh, but you can't use four syllable words in a book for key stage six readers or something. I don't know. I don't know what these things mean, but I just don't know that. So I kind of ignore it. And I assume that, you know, if an editor, so for example, Pugs of the Frozen North was originally, and I shall say this quietly so as not to offend my 33 pugs, it was originally going to be called Chihuahuas of the Frozen North. But our editors said, oh, you know, children can't read that word. It looks like chi-hua-hua to them. They won't know what that means, which is a fair point. So we changed it. Pugs. Everybody can read that. Even pugs, interestingly. So, you know, you take advice from editors, but I don't tend to sit there thinking, who is my target audience? I tend to think, what do I want to read next? You know, what do I want to happen? I have to entertain myself, basically, and hope that if it does that, then it will entertain somebody else as well. It's a lot more about tone than vocabulary or syntax or anything. It's about the tone of the story. You know, if you're, you know, a teenager can deal or will want to deal with much darker and more complex things than I think I would want to read to a six-year-old. So my books for younger readers tend to be comedy, and they tend to be fairly harmless comedy. You know, nobody really gets hurt. Nothing very bad happens. Occasionally something bad looks like it's going to happen, but then it's always averted quite soon. Because I don't want to scare little children. That's not my job. Whereas the older books, I tend to think, you know, people can cope with whatever I want to throw at them.
Mm. I think also with children's books, especially for younger audiences, they know when it doesn't feel right, or if you're trying to kind of talk down to them, and it doesn't feel right at all. I think children are really quite, I mean, I have a sample size of one to base this on, but well, yes. It's quite astute at, you know, things which feel real and things that don't feel as kind of genuine or exciting as or as the authentic. So Pugs of the Frozen North am I right in thinking it's the third?
It is the third.
Oh,
yes.
Good, yes, because we've got the first two, so I'm glad I haven't accidentally missed one out. So there are four planned, aren't there?
Well, I hope there's going to be loads more after that of some description or other, because I do enjoy working with the McIntyre. But we have a contract for four of these books, and then after that, I think we might need to take a year off for Sarah to catch up with all her picture book work, and then we shall plunge off in some other direction, and maybe we'll return to some of the characters we've written about already, or maybe we'll have new things to write about. I'm not sure. But yeah, we want to keep going, I think, as a team.
Yeah, well, it's the work that you produce is so enjoyable. I hope that's true. So the book, The Pugs of the Frozen North, has completely new characters again?
Yes, they're all new characters. I really didn't have, again, coming to these books from the Mortal Engines thing. And after Mortal Engines, I did some prequels set in the same world called the Fever Crumb series, I guess they were called. That was the name of the central character. And I really didn't want to get into another series. I didn't want to get into another set of books where you have the same characters setting off on a different wacky adventure in each one. So I was very determined, and I think Sarah agreed, that they should all be about different things. And also, why limit yourself, really? You know, what links these books is that they're all drawn by Sarah and they're all written by me, and they kind of have a spirit in common. They're all basically comedy adventures, I suppose. But no, they don't have the same characters or the same settings or anything. They're as different as we can make them, basically. The first one was a kind of magical adventure with mermaids and octopuses and things, and the second one, we went to space and did kind of, I set out to write sort of the hardest science fiction story I could think of writing for kind of a younger age group. So, I tried to be quite sort of detailed about how the spaceship works, all that kind of stuff. And then I Skyped McIntyre and said, okay, what happens next? And she said, killer cakes! So, slightly lost some of its scientific veracity, but it did gain killer cakes. So I feel that was a good trade-off.
Yes. So in Pugs of the Frozen North, are they like sledge, I don't know what we would call them, sledge dogs? Or, I don't know, like huskies?
It's about a boy, he's the cabin boy on a ship, and it becomes frozen in the ice when this whole sea freezes in this sort of magical winter that comes to the north but once in a lifetime. And he is left in charge of the cargo, which is a lot of pugs, 66 pugs, in fact. And there's a girl who lives nearby who is hoping to join this magical sled race to the North Pole, but she hasn't got any huskies to pull her sled. So they pool their resources, basically. She has a sled, he has 33 pugs, they're off. It's kind of Jack London with pugs, which I'm looking for, really.
And hopefully not as bleak.
No. So it's a bit. Oh, it's also a bit wacky races, I think, because there are various other competitors all trying to reach the North Pole. So a strong element of, well, both wacky races and those magnificent men in their flying machines.
Oh, marvellous.
There's a villain who is quite definitely Terry Thomas.
Oh, sold. That sounds wonderful. Now, something I'm obviously looking forward to Pugs of the Frozen North because me, my son and I read those books together and we enjoy them immensely. But Railhead, I am particularly selfishly excited about. So what can you tell me about Railhead?
Well, Railhead is kind of my return to kind of long form science fiction novels, really, which I thought I'd abandoned. After the whole Mortal Engines and Fever Crumb experience. But when I started working with Sarah McIntyre, we did Sea Wigs together. And kind of at the launch party for that, we were on the Golden Hind in London, the replica galleon on the Thames there. And I was dressed in a sort of vaguely piratical or sailor-like outfit. And Sarah had a 9-foot-tall wig on her head with a ship on the top, as you do.
As you do.
And I kind of thought, I remember writing used to be fun. I used to enjoy it, you know, it used to be good. And it sort of inspired me to go back to a space opera that I'd made a start on. I'd always wanted to write a space opera because I grew up on things like Star Wars and Star Trek and stuff like that. So I'd always been quite fond of the genre. So I've made various stabs at this thing and I got it out and started writing again. And there were some characters I liked and a lot of little good bits that I thought were worth keeping, but I couldn't make it work. I couldn't find any way of writing about spaceships that was remotely interesting, strangely, because I think visually I love spaceships. I like them. It's probably telling that the inspirational space operas I mentioned were film and TV rather than books, because I think it's the visuals of them I like. You know, this sort of kind of great chunks of abstract design on the hoof. I rather like that in a spaceship. But when you actually start writing about them, it was very hard to make mine different in any way to other people's spaceships. I had to sort of break the laws of physics by giving them wormholes to go through so that they could get from planet to planet within the space of a book, you know. And then one day I just thought, well, if they had wormholes, they wouldn't even need spaceships. And then I realized that was an advantage because they could just go through them in trains, and that would be much better because trains are very much more interesting than spaceships and a great deal more romantic. And everybody has had that experience. Almost none of us have ever been on a spacecraft, but almost all of us have been on trains. So at that point, it became a train opera rather than a space opera. And I basically binned it and started again with a few, carrying over a few of the characters and a few of the ideas I'd had about how this future society might develop. And I wrote a new story about trains, effectively. Well, it isn't about trains, but it's set upon trains and around trains. A heist story, basically.
Sounds marvellous.
About a young thief who's recruited to pinch an immensely valuable, well, no, a very obscure and not very valuable seeming object from the Imperial train. And then when he has pinched it, discovers that actually it is quite valuable and indeed dangerous. So so that's how it all kicks off. And I've had a lot of fun with it, really. I think it's the science fiction novel that I would write now, whereas Mortal Engines was the one that I wrote when I was 25 or whatever. So it sort of reflects where I am at the moment, I think.
I'm looking forward to it immensely. So something I like to ask all of my friends that I take tea with is something which is actually related to the chickens over there that are not ordinary chickens. What I'd like to ask you is, if you could have a theme tune of your life, what would it be? And we'll see if the chickens know it, because they're very good singers.
I think the song that has kind of come to represent my life as it is now is a song that I wrote with Sarah McIntyre, because all our books have to have a theme tune, of course, as books do. This is one of the reasons why we're market leaders. It's because we have a theme tune that can hum as they read the book. And our first hit was the Sea Monkey song, which goes with Oliver and the Sea Wigs and has a catchy chorus, which basically consists of the words eep, 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 eep. And I think it, you know, it's very beautiful when we sing it, but I think it would be even more beautiful when sung by chickens.
Marvellous. Okay, then, little chickens, could you possibly sing the Sea Monkey Eep song for Philip, please? And there they go.
That was fantastic. That was one of the most moving experiences of my life.
They're very talented chickens.
They are. Where did you find them?
Well, they were a gift. Oh. And I still don't know who sent them to me. I seem to have a rather strange secret admirer, and that was the gift they sent me. So who knows? Who knows where they came from? So that was the theme song for Oliver and the Sea Wigs. Is there a song that you have in mind when you think about Railhead?
Yes. Railhead sort of has this, as soon as I thought about trains, for some reason I started thinking about kind of German electronica from the 1970s. So I think the only song that I could ask your chickens to sing for Railhead really is Trans-Europe Express by Kraftwerk.
Okay, little chickens. Now, you usually don't have two songs to sing in one day, but we'll see how they go. So could you sing Trans-Europe Express by Kraftwerk, please? And there they go. They can do electronica as well. They're very versatile. They've gone from, I don't know, O Fortuna to the Star Wars Imperial March.
Yes, you know. I'm sure you could monetize these chickens. You should send them on tour or something. Book the Albert Hall for a chicken recital.
Can you imagine? That would be brilliant. Well, let me just check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. Oh, but it's been such a marvellous delight having you in the tea lair. And what I'll do is I'll put the remaining pug cakes into this box and you can take them with you and have them for the journey home.
I might save McIntyre one. Thank you.
Marvellous. Well, do take care, and I hope I'll be able to see you again soon.
I hope so. Thank you ever so much, Emma. It's been lovely.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Don't worry about him, little chickens. He's just the museum attendant.
It's not often we get a guest of your calibre here, sir. Could you just pose for a few minutes while we take your likeness for the waxwork?
Oh, that's nice. I think Philip will make a splendid addition to the museum. Goodness, I didn't realise it was so involved. I wonder what that giant machine is for. Is that a camera?
Of a sort.
What's that on the side? Waxomatic 2000. Excuse me, those big cylinders of wax that you're putting into the top of the machine, what are they for exactly?
For making a waxwork, of course.
But why are you pointing the nozzle at Philip?
Philip is perfect. And once I have coated him in the special wax, he will stay perfect. Forever.
You can't do that.
Too late.
Lummy, I can't stand here and be transformed into a wax effigy. I'm a busy man. Unleash the pugs!
Curse you, Reeve.
Oh, what clever pugs. They seem to have made everything better. Well, for Philip, at least. Whilst the pugs are chasing that evil attendant around the building, I would like to raise my teacup to Anassa, the newest member of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. Would you also permit me to mention that my upcoming science fiction novel, Planetfall, is now available for pre-order? You can find details at my website, enewman.co.uk. I would also dearly love to see you at its launch, which will be at the Forbidden Planet London Megastore on October 29th, 2015, at 6 p.m. The book will be available there several days earlier than the official release of November 3rd, and I'll be able to scribble something in your copy if you like. Hello? Oh, yes, you're Mr. Wolf's associate.
Yes, I understand you're having problems with your butler. It sounds as if it could be a demon in disguise. Eating your books, Mrs. Newman.
Latimer? Is that you? Oh, well, this is awkward. Are you well?
Indeed, ma'am. I decided that before my next post I would take temporary employment as a fixer of problems. As the advert says, if you've got a problem, and no one else can help, and you can find...
Latimer?
Yes, ma'am?
What about the book eater?
In order to remove him... we will need to collect a very specific set of items. One is in Dublin, another in Nottingham, and the last one is in a place too terrible to mention.
This sounds like a quest. If only I had a reliable butler to help me.
A complimentary butler will be provided as part of the service.
Oh, splendid. Do you know who it will be, Latimer?
Yes, I know him very well, ma'am. Very well indeed.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.